Welcome to Needle Exchange, exploring the world through the eye of the needle. My name's Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X-Stitch, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Hattie McGill, an embroidery artist and costume specialist whose gold work has graced screens from Doctor Strange to Bridgerton. In this first part, we explore Hattie's training at the Royal School of Needlework, her unexpected leap from furniture restoration into embroidery, and the behind-the-scenes craftsmanship that goes into cinematic costume design. It's great talking with Hattie. I've known her for a long time and her skills are excellent, and I was super excited when I sort of realised that she was in the world of film, seeing behind the scenes, getting her work on the big screen in the Marvel Universe and all kinds of period dramas. It's so good. We have such a lovely talk. She's got excellent skills and she knows how to use them. If you want another artist whose embroidery skills are Royal School of Needlework approved, then be sure to check out episodes 17 and 18 with the wonderful Chrissy Juno Mann. And if you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to subscribe. And if you're able to leave a review on your podcasting platform, that will help us get more artist stories into more people's ears. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation with Hattie. But until then, enjoy the show. So I had a thing that said that you started learning embroidery when you were three. Is that true?
That is true.
That's very early to be playing with a needle. Please explain.
Well, that's the family legend.
Go on.
There's in a scrapbook that my mum had, a piece of cross stitch that says mummy on it. Well, you know, like the classic, it's got some pasta in there.
Mixed media.
Yeah. And underneath it, it says by Harriet, age three.
Did you stitch that as well? Or was that written by somebody? Wow.
Apparently I wrote it. I'm sure I got a lot of help, but I think, yeah. Because my mum was really into like crafty, textile-y type things. And I think my sister and I were very annoying children that didn't sit still. Mm-hmm. For very long, so we always had to be doing something. So I think we did get taught quite young.
I mean, three's young, isn't it? Hats off to her for doing it.
But to be honest, my sister is convinced that she did it, and that it's mislabeled wrong.
Right.
But I'm taking claim. It's got my name underneath it.
You're the one with the embroidery career.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your earliest stitching memory, would you say?
Probably learning to sew buttons on at Brownies.
Right.
Learning to do blanket stitch at Brownies.
Right.
Which I think I must have been, I don't know how young I was there. I was in junior school, but probably that.
Yeah. Did you sew your own badges on? Those things are tough to sew on, man.
Yeah. Did all that. And I don't think you get a badge for even sewing on your own badges, which is just...
And they don't make them iron on, like we've got some, because Annie's doing rainbows. She's got a few badges. Flora, who's a bit older, is doing beavers, pre-cubs, right? She absolutely loves it. It lights her up. She gets loads of badges. You can't machine sew them. So I've got this stuff here called ThimTech. I'll show you it. It's almost like tape that you might use on wounds and stuff, but they've designed it so it's basically like thimble tape. You'd love it. So you can wrap it around your thumbs and a few layers of that. I'll send you some.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to get that because I just use microporous tape and then it just gets really sticky.
Yeah, these guys designed it. It comes in cool colours as well. I've got some. I'll send you some. But we have to use that because it's brutal trying to sew those things in by hand.
That's so thick. And then, like, making kids do it and you're like, your fingers are bleeding.
My wife's just like, don't do any more badges, not because I don't want you to achieve, but I can't take the pain.
Ridiculous.
It is quite ridiculous. I'm
glad to know that it hasn't developed though since when I did it in like the early 90s.
No, they're still made of layers of Hessian with a leather binding just to keep them in good shape.
Yeah.
You just hammer the nail straight through or something. Tell me how it is that you came to be what I consider like the Hollywood A-lister of needlework. That's the strap line. I'm just gonna write that down now, actually.
Okay, well, I like that title. I don't know. Well, I was at the Royal School of Needlework studying embroidery. And I think I was in my second year and we had a show. I think it might have been at Farnham and my work was up there. And the costume designer, Alex Byrne, saw my work there and offered me a job. and said, I'm doing this film. Do you want to come and do it? Just, I need an embroiderer. Do you just want to help out over the summer for like a few weeks? I was like, sure, sounds great. And that few weeks turned into, I think I was there for 9 months.
Wowzers.
That was Doctor Strange.
Wow.
And so then I was doing my third year at the same time. And then she took me on to her next job and then a couple more jobs. And then by that point, my name had sort of got out there and a few more costume designers, you know, hired me. And then that must have been like 10, 11 years ago now, something like that.
That's amazing. How did you come to be in the Royal School of Needlework in the first place?
I did it on a whim, completely.
Wasn't interested in needlework in the slightest. I mean, I've been doing it since I was three.
I've been doing it for ages, and I'd had like a little Etsy shop where I was like selling things through that and doing embroidery. But I actually had done a degree in furniture restoration and conservation, the decorative arts. And so I'd done that and then was working in antique dealers in Rye after uni, but still wasn't quite sure. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. Kind of still was like loving my embroidery and would do it on the slide, just do it when the shop was quiet, would just sew in there. And someone walked past one day and popped in and said, oh, can I see what you're working on? So I just showed them and she was like, oh, this is amazing. Did you study at the Royal School of Needlework? And I was like, there's a Royal School of Needlework? I had no idea about this. And this was possibly like May or June. So like the next term was starting quite quickly. And so I just looked it up, thought this sounds amazing. I think I went and messaged Angie and said, can I come and just have a look round to see what it was like? And then next thing I knew, I'd applied, gone for an interview, got in and had to tell my parents I was going back to do a second degree. And I was actually enrolled onto a master's of the history of furniture at the time. So I had to then tell them, being like, no, I'm not coming to do this in September. I'm going to go back and do another degree. So yeah, that was it. So then went off to the Royal School of Needlework instead. Had that been there, maybe when I went to do my degree in the first place, I probably would have done that, but I don't think it was established, or I think it was quite new when I had.
Yeah, the degree course kind of isn't that old in the scheme of things, isn't it? Because they had other things, didn't they, like apprenticeships and whatnots, but they didn't formally get a degree up and running. I sort of remember that coming around. That's how long I've been in the game. But you got a first for your furniture restoration in the first place. So what do you do in a degree for furniture restoration other than?
Well, in my mind, originally, I was like, I'm going to present the Antiques Roadshow. That was like my thought, because I thought it'd be great. But no, I originally went into it because I was really interested in like DT at school and also textiles, and I couldn't see a way to sort of combine the two. So I found this course and I thought, oh, this is great. I could learn to be a traditional upholsterer, mm-hmm. which was really good fun. But my God, it is hard. Like, it is hard work. It is physical work. And I can see why traditionally all upholsterers were men, because that's like really tough. And I definitely wasn't strong enough. But we did lots of things. So we learned to build furniture, and then we did things like we tried everything, which was like upholstery, French polishing, marquetry, gilding, all sorts. And then we sort of picked an area to specialise in. And I specialised in gilding, so making things gold. And then ended up being one of the guilders on the Cutty Sark at the end of it in the restoration. So,
of course. Why would? Oh, that's amazing. Being so what, on a restoration of, because I mean, how old's a Cutty Sark?
Very old. But it had a fire, it burnt down, so they were redoing it. So I got invited to be part of the team that like did the gilded letters and stuff on the side that say like London. So yeah, that's quite fun. And then I went to work in the antique dealers, and then
the rest is history. I used to watch a program called The New Yankee Workshop, which is a guy called Norm MacDonald. I've actually got a plush toy version of him somewhere. And he's got a massive workshop in America, and he'd go to like a shaker house or something, and he'd be like, here's this cabinet and I'm going to go back to my place and make it. And he'd recreate it. And you'd only ever see him doing the cuts. You wouldn't see him spending age in doing the jigs. But the bit I loved was polishing at the end. And he'd be like, so I put on 35 coats of lacquer and now we're just down to the tiny wire wool bit, where he's literally trying to get it like an ice rink or something.
It's mad. French polishing is such an art. Like, it's like, yeah, it's just mad. Occasionally I watch a repair shop and I'm like, I wouldn't do it like that.
But isn't it like you put layers on and you sand them and you just use finer and finer sand and the layers get smaller?
And it's all about like the action that you do it, like you drag it all across and stuff. I mean, I haven't done it for years, so I really have no idea what I'm talking about anymore. But I'm sure it's still in there somewhere.
There's a curious thing that struck to my mind now with the fact that then you, so you did that and you did gilding and you ended up on the Cutty Sark, and then gold work is your jam. Like, you and gold, it's the thing.
Apparently, I'm just attracted to gold shiny things, it would seem.
At what point then did that come out in the needlework? Because you do the degree, don't you? First year, you learn all the stitches, canvas work, all of those sorts of things. Second year, you start to experiment, don't you? I guess, broadly speaking. When did gold work become the thing?
Gold, I don't think it became a thing for me until after I'd left.
Right.
Like I did a bit. And I remember incorporating like my gilding into some of my embroidery and gold leafing some stuff. But I don't think I actually really got into gold work until I left. When I think I was on the degree, I was really into stump work and 3D and that sort of thing. Because I remember my final project was all about Dutch still life paintings, and I recreated like 3D flowers and moths and things out of that. So I was really into like that side of things. I guess I quite liked how it all went together.
Mm.
And then the gold work definitely came later. And I can't remember how, to be honest.
Do you think it might have been driven by the like the film stuff? Because I guess a lot of that embroidery would have been that territory, right?
Maybe. I mean, I haven't actually done much gold work for films until about, I think, Bridgerton and Wicked, I think I did some. But up until then, it hadn't really come up. I think I just dabbled with a bit of gold work and then put it up on Instagram and it was quite popular. And then I had a real hankering one day to make a gold work lobster. And then that was like super popular. And then since then, it just sort of, I just wanted to do more and more and more. Because it's all, I guess it's also like the same way I loved gilding so much, is that the final like short bit of it is the gold on the top. The rest is all the prep underneath. So you spend a lot of time like doing the base work and prepping and getting everything right to then put the gold on. And it's the same with gold work. You spend hours padding and getting it perfect so that when you put the gold on top, it is like bucker sort of. But yeah, sort of just sort of fell into the gold work thing. And now it's, in my own work, it's like 90% of what I do.
Mm. But not all gold work has to be gold, right?
Oh, no, because my gold work is, a lot of it's quite colourful. So, but it's just like a thing for metal.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you do a gold work 101 then? Can you explain it so that we can understand? In the same way as like not all black work is black work, or maybe it's not all blackbirds are blackbirds, I'm not sure. Can you do a gold work 101?
I can try. So gold work, it was originally gold metal threads, but nowadays it sort of covers all sorts of coloured metal threads. There's like a huge range, but traditionally was used in like ecclesiastical and military embroidery, like the badges and stuff. And it's a different type of embroidery because instead of, you're attaching something to your thread to stitch down. So it's a bit like beading in a way. So you cut your gold and it's you get different types of, you get, I won't go through them all now because they've all got ridiculous names like smooth pearl, bright check. But they generally, you get couching ones where obviously you stitch over, and then you get pearls, which you cut, which have a hole in the middle and you thread on like a needle, thread on like a bead. So it's more like, I guess, surface embroidery as opposed to, you're not using it like you would normal, like coloured floss going through the fabric.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you pad it and build up layers and stuff like that.
And it's beautiful.
It's very beautiful and shiny.
There's something about the arrangement of couching stitches, isn't there? Like ways of doing that and that being an element in and of itself.
Yes, couching is, you know, for such a simple technique, it has so many different ways it can look just on like the direction of stitching and the way the light catches and things like that.
Is that something you gain from experience, or is that something you can be taught, or do you sort of feel it out?
I think you can be taught it for sure, But I also think gold work's very, people are put off by gold work because it looks so, like you see some gold work, especially in like museums and stuff, and you're like, that's insane. But when you break it down, it's actually quite, not, you know, easy to understand. And so I think I quite like that it looks really impressive, but actually it isn't that hard in terms of a stitch, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like magic tricks, isn't it? You know, magic tricks can look brilliant because they're executed very well, but the mechanics of them are not necessarily complicated.
Exactly, yeah. So it's just sort of knowing all those bits and getting to understand how to work with it, because sometimes it's fiddly and it's a lot of trial and error with gold work, because you'll be cutting something to length and it has to be the perfect length. And it's rare that I will cut it to length perfectly the first time. And I think that often can put people off, because you're quite often being like, oh, that doesn't look right, I'll unthread it and start again.
Do you just have to learn to go slower?
Yeah. And I guess over time you do probably get a bit better at gauging what's going to work and what's not, and different threads and things. But yeah, I think it is about going slower and being a bit careful.
Mm. When the last time I saw you was at the Stitch Festival last March, and hey, that was really nice to see you. But I was working with the degree students in the Royal School of Needlework, which is a little formula that I have if I ever do those things. But what was lovely was having, like, one day there were some first years and some second years. And the second years, you know, at the end of the first year, you've got your sampler, haven't you? You've got your frame and it's got all the stitches on. And it's quite funny because the first years, halfway through the first, you were looking at the samplers from the previous year being like, oh my God, how are we ever going to do that? And then the second years are looking back going, oh my God, that's so rubbish. And it's just so funny to see both of those perspectives on the same thing, you know, and realize how far you can travel with these things.
Yeah.
Because like a lot of the stuff you're talking about to other people would seem unfeasible, because at the RSN you learn, I always say they learn like Pope level embroidery or whatever, because it kind of is like that, right?
It is like that, yeah.
But it's fascinating how impossible it seems, and yet it is achievable if you, I guess, take the time, go slow. How many, like, battles have you gone through with yourself, like battles of persistence? It sounds dramatic, but, you know, like, you hit barriers in your own abilities and stuff. Do you recognise any of those?
Oh, yeah, I've lost count of the amount of times that I've just been like, what are you doing, Hattie? You're rubbish at this. You need to quit your job. I don't know, and become a post lady is like, I always think is my backup. Sometimes you're just having like one of those days where you just like can't thread a needle,
mm-hmm.
which is just like day one of the Royal School of Needlework. And I'm like, why can't I do this? But you know, you always have those days. And then sometimes you've just got to go back and do something that you like, you know, not that you know you can do, but like you don't have to like think about too much mm-hmm. to get back the groove of it, to just try the new thing that you're trying again.
Maybe like playing a cover version of a song when you're trying to write your own music.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm. Do you still use the waist knot technique? Is that your favourite starting technique?
That's, yeah.
Rock solid.
Still do that. And in all like my kits, I explain it at the beginning of every kit to the point where I just feel like everyone's bored of me talking about the waist knot.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I'd be the same, but you realise you're the only one who hears it every single time or whatever, isn't it? It's quite natural. I always used to do that because when I would teach cross stitch, and we are just talking cross stitch, it's not rocket science, but it would be like I teach the loop technique because it's the easiest way to start, because it is. And then when they've wrapped their heads around it, the waist knot technique is the easiest, the most useful, but it's quite complicated to explain because you sort of have to say, well, you're going to put the knot in the direction you're going to stitch over. And it's a lot to learn in the first place. But I would always be like, and that's how they teach you to the Royal School of Needlework. So that's how the Queen does it. And just roll on with that. It's just how it goes. Really,
it is. It does feel like a very backward way to start the waist knot.
Mm.
Like in terms of you're like, yeah, you're starting on the top. Your knot is on the top.
Mm.
But don't worry, we'll cut it off at the end. Yeah, so it does like, for people who are just starting, they're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just kind of overwhelming, isn't it? Whereas the rest of the time, I'm like, take both hands, put them in. I've got all my whole little thing. And then I always do a thing where, with the loop technique, where when you put the needle through the loop on the bottom and then it tags, you go, because it's like, and sometimes people are like, that's genius. And I'm like, yeah, definitely is genius. Don't ask an actual genius. But then when I'm teaching them later and I'm going, oh, you know, you've got to do the same thing again, I'm like, do the thing, do that, and then it kind of goes on, and it's quite a little useful, like, teaching method, that.
But you remember things that way, I think.
Mm, yeah.
That's how it sticks in your head.
But I mean, I'm really lucky because it's like teaching cross stitch. You know what I mean, it's like the simplest, the simplest. Do you do much teaching?
I used to do it a lot more, but I haven't done it probably since the pandemic, like before the pandemic. But yeah, no, I'd like to probably get back into it.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I guess, again, you're not going to be teaching. I mean, you'd be good at teaching cross-stitch, but you're not going to teach cross-stitch, are you? You're going to be teaching the good stuff. And I suppose that requires a certain context. You know, just...
I'd teach anything, to be honest. We always used to say that cross-stitch was the gateway drug to embroidery.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I call it. You start with cross-stitch, move on to harder crafts after that. I always quite like talking about the Royal School of Needlework as though it's some kind of Harry Potter thing as well, because it just sounds like it should be, doesn't it?
I mean, it's in a palace.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. They study in a palace. They have butlers. There are ghosts. All of those.
Yeah, there are ghosts for sure.
What was it like, though? I mean, for you, like, you did 3 years. It was a long time ago. Like, how do you look back on it all now?
Oh, I loved it. I had the best time. I don't know if, like, I had a different mindset because I'd already done a degree. I'd been away at uni. So I wasn't really, like, there for, like, the uni experience or anything like that. I just wanted to sew. Like, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to embroider. And obviously doing my furniture stuff, obviously love like my history and things like that. So being in a palace, obviously I was obsessed with. And yeah, I just loved it. It was so much fun. Obviously there's times when it's stressful and you've got deadlines and things like that, but you're in a palace and like, I can't imagine the amount of either tourist photos that I'm in or have taken pictures of. And sometimes you'd just get a bit blasé about it and then you'd have to remember like, oh my God, no, this is where Henry VIII lived.
Yes, I'm sure some of his wives were killed here, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the science, the history, but... And do you, like, that was the thing, yeah, like deadlines and those kind of things, because it's quite funny, isn't it, in this day and age, if you've got a dissertation to write, you can get ChatGPT to do it in 10 hours, but you can't get anybody to stitch the stuff you need to do, can you?
No. No, so I remember doing the degree, being up late and really stitching and having to tell myself, like, you are not going to get this done. So you have to make a compromise with yourself about the final result, which I think was really useful for me because otherwise you'd just kill yourself. And, like, it's hard to pull an all-nighter stitching because then you're just unpicking what you did in the morning because it's crap because you're blind.
Mm.
So, yeah, you can't, and I've had this in films as well, you can't stitch faster. Like it is a slow active. It's a slow thing. It takes as long as it takes.
Mm. And how do you predict that? Because I guess from a project management standpoint, the most boring bit of the conversation is happening now. From a project management standpoint, like, do you know now how much you can get done in an hour, roughly speaking?
Sometimes.
Right.
Sometimes I'm like, that I can do. Other times I still will get it way off. Because you just don't know. Because unless you're doing repeats, no stitching sort of session is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything's different. So there's so many variables that, you know, can happen. Sometimes I'm good at it. Sometimes I'm not.
Okay. So let's do a little rundown of the TV and film titles you've been involved in. That will give us a good place to start as I try and unearth the secrets of the movie industry. But what stuff have you done then?
I don't know. It's hard for me to remember, but I'll go from Doctor Strange, and then I did Murder on the Orient Express.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have done Death on the Nile.
Right.
When they did those ones. And then Mary, Queen of Scots. Oh, my God. You know what? I can't really remember.
Bridgerton probably would have arrived somewhere in that equation, right?
Bridgerton came a bit later.
Like second series budget, maybe. I don't know.
But yeah, because I did the second series of Bridgerton.
Mm.
So I went to it when they had done series one, but it wasn't out yet.
Right.
So... we'd no idea what it was going to be like, if it was going to be a success. I hadn't heard of it. But I think I got to watch the first episode on my first day so that they could be like, this is mm-hmm. this is it. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise it was like a new world. Because all I'd heard was it's like Jane Austen meets Gossip Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then Bridgerton.
Did you do a second Doctor Strange?
No, I didn't do the second Doctor Strange. I think they had a different costume designer.
Right.
I also think possibly the cloaks might have. I don't know if they still use the cloaks. I did 21 of them, so.
21 cloaks.
Yeah. So I feel, I don't know. So I didn't do that. And then, yeah, then Bridgerton. And then I went on to the Bridgerton spin-off of Queen Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
Straight from Queen Charlotte, went on to Wicked mm-hmm. for a year and a half.
Because Wicked's been, they've filmed several of those together, haven't they, or something?
Yeah, we did the two films back to back.
Right, right.
So the trailer for the second one was out this week. And I was like, oh, I forgot about those things. Because it was so long ago. So then, and I've done a few other bits in between. I can't even remember these days.
Mm. It's so satisfying, though, because I think I've said this to you as well. I remember doing talks at the RSN at, like, I don't know, 2010, whenever the first time I tried to blag my way in there, just being like, good luck, everybody. You're going to get a degree in hand embroidery. Enjoy working at Tesco. But thanks to like high def telly. And I mean, yeah, like, what was it? Game of Thrones probably unlocked a bunch of stuff, didn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones and then the Marvel movies and all those kind of things. And suddenly there's quite a few careers going back. Although from what you said to me, it's still not a big world. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I've done really well. Like, I think I've had solid, like, every year we'll have a good big film for, like, the last 10, you know, 8 years or something. So I've done quite well. But then there's times, like, this year has been really quiet because it's just, like, not every film needs an embroiderer. So it's just, you know, it just depends. But then also the pool of people doing embroidery for film, there's a few of us, but it's still quite a small world. So we're sort of not fighting over the same jobs, but, you know, there aren't a huge amount of jobs to go around in the first place.
Do you know Michelle Carragher?
I've met her at the RSM, but I've never worked with her.
To me, she's like the OG, isn't she?
Oh, yes, she is. Yeah.
I've got to get her on here at some point, to be honest.
Oh, you do? You should. I think she might have given out our awards at maybe my third year at the RSN, at like the awards evening.
Mm. So let's drill into it then a little bit. We'll talk Doctor Strange, nice and easy one to begin with. How you sign an NDA, so you can't tell us anything at the time or whatever, but how does the process go? Like, do you have lots of conversations with the costume lead, or do they send you some designs? Do they have an understanding of what it's going to take to realise those, or do you have to be part of that, like, information process?
It really it depends on the job and the designer.
Right.
So on Doctor Strange, I think Alex Byrne had quite a set idea of what she wanted and a design. And I just did a lot of sampling to see like the best way that we could achieve that. And so that was quite straightforward. But there was, yeah, so she was quite like, this is what I want. Can you recreate that? And I did Emma with her as well, actually. That was another really good one. And that was the same thing. She was like, this is what I'm looking for. And then you go, I can do that. And you copy it. Like, I think I copied a V&A dress.
Right.
But then there's some designers who are like, I kind of want this feel or this vibe. And they might give you some reference images of various things. And then you'll go away and you'll sample and they'll go, oh, no, I like this or I want this. And so, yeah, it just really depends on. It varies from job to job.
And
if I'm working from home, sometimes it's a lot more like, just see what you can do with this sort of thing.
Right. But I guess, I mean, I'm wondering whether when you get things like a Doctor Strange or, for the sake of argument, up against something like a Murder on the Orient Express, or like there's less specific references, like fantasy, do you get more free rein to just kind of go whatever because you're not trying to tie it into a particular era?
I think fantasy, you do get that, which is why Wicked was great, because it wasn't, you can't pinpoint it to any era. So that we did get a lot of free reign out over in terms of like what we could get away with. But yeah, things like Murder on the Orient Express, which is like specifically of a time, then you're a bit more limited. But
so Doctor Strange, you do cloaks. What do you do on Murder on the Orient Express? What kind of stuff are you doing there?
That was a fun one. That one I did, Michelle Pfeiffer had this amazing, like, entirely cross-stitched, actually. It was, like, very cross-stitched. Like, I think it was a dress. I did that. I did two of those. And things like that. Most of my time, I think I spent, like, 6 months on those two dresses, like, just purely cross-stitch. I did a few bits for Judi Dench's costume on that. And I did a... Actually, I remember I did a handkerchief that was monogrammed that was meant to be like a clue that they found at the scene. So that was fun. But it didn't, so I spent ages on it. Beautiful silk monogram, was really happy with it. They loved it. And then when I watched the film, I think Poirot uses it to, he picks it up and then holds like to stem a wound. So it just gets really bloody anyway. So.
Do you have to get a bit of detachment from it once you've handed it in? Because it's like, it might not make it at all.
Yeah, I think I learned that on that job. I was just like, I was so proud of that handkerchief. And then I was like, oh. And so since then, I'm just like, for me, the enjoyment is doing it. So if whatever happens, you know, it doesn't matter. Like I did on Queen Charlotte, I did these chain stitch braces, and they didn't use it as a costume. It was just used as like set dressing. And I did another handkerchief. It's always handkerchiefs for me on Queen Charlotte, which was monogrammed, and I had hand tatted all the lace around the handkerchief and everything, and it's in it for approximately 10 seconds, and I think the Prince Regent is blowing his nose on it. So
do you think the actors have got any concept of, like, the effort that's gone into that thing? He's just blowing his nose on.
Possibly not, but at the same time, I was like, I love doing that handkerchief. So for me, it was just like, you know, I got paid to do that, so it's a win for me.
And you'd never get any of it back, would you?
No.
No.
I've got the odd tiny sample, which I don't know if I'm ever meant to give them back, that, like, I've got a bit of a Doctor Strange sample of his cloak.
Right.
Yeah, things like that, but nothing big I don't get back. They probably just go into storage somewhere.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? That thing of like they're used, you do two dresses, maybe they both get worn for a little while. They sort of end up as part of a film that unless you're an embroidery nerd or a fashion nerd, you're not really going to pay a lot of attention to. It still strikes me as funny that they go to all this effort. Like you said, hand tatting around the edge of a hanky, someone blows his nose on or something.
Yeah.
Like the effort's quite remarkable.
Yeah, and I think it is because of people, I think, pay attention more these days. And also because of, like, yeah, high def and, you know, all that.
And you can sort of freeze it now as well, whereas you couldn't back in the day, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Mm.
So that's the reason.
What did you do for Wicked then?
What didn't I do for Wicked?
Come on. I haven't seen him, full disclosure. I've got a girl dad. I need to get up on that.
It's really good. So I moved on Bridgerton. I started out and it was just me, and then we brought in another embroiderer. And then I moved with Beth. I moved with her onto Queen Charlotte, and then we both were on Wicked. So we sort of, she's like my work embroidery wife. We sort of moved together. So it was me and her, and then we headed up like a little team because there was just so much work. So between us, we did like Glinda's main pink bubble dress that's on all the posters. And I did quite a lot of gold work in that for Fiero's like military stuff. Just loads of things like embroidered buttons. We were on it for a year and a half, just constantly just doing things and like silk embroidery on shirts and all sorts. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was really good fun.
Mm. And so how much were you led on that? How much did you get any free rein?
A little bit. We sampled, like, with the designer's incredible. I mean, he won an Oscar, so for it. He's amazing. But, so again, like, he'd have, like, a vision of what he'd want, and then we'd sample it and try different things, and then he'd go, no, this is the direction I want, or different things. So, yeah, but not, like, massive.
Would you get overlap with, like, you know, she's got a wand, she's got a crown, presumably there's jewellery and all those kind of things. Do you get much crossover with those departments?
We didn't so much, but I have had that on other jobs where we've had crossover, and I've had crossover actually both on Wicked and probably Queen Charlotte and Bridgerton crossover with the millinery department.
Mm.
So that we make sure like there's cohesiveness between like embellishment and embroidery on the cloth clothes to like a hat and hair pieces and things like that.
Mm.
But Wicked was a massive, massive team of like leather workers, milliners, dyers, breakdown artists. Like it was huge. It was such an inspiring place to be.
And are you operating, are you going to work when you do that? Or are you working from home or?
That one I was in the studios in Elstree.
Right.
But then occasionally they're really good. They would be like, oh, if you need to work from home on certain days, you can. So yeah, some jobs I'm like contracted in a studio for like months on end, and then other jobs, it'll be just like little freelance bits and I'll just do it from my studio here.
Mm.
So it just depends.
Conveniently located not that far from Elstree, now that we stop and think about it, isn't it? That's quite handy.
Annoyingly, moved here a week after I finished Wicked. So, terrible timing.
That would have been that. So. But I mean, do you now get wind of projects? Have you got people who, because you're like on the inside, right? So how does that kind of pan out?
Yeah, you do get wind of, you know, because I know a lot of people in the industry, you get wind of like, oh, so-and-so's setting up crew for this, or so-and-so's doing this. And you sort of hope that someone's going to message you and say, are you free?
Mm.
Or you just have to be ballsy and go, I'm available to work if you need anyone. But yeah, you do get a sense of what's coming up and what's happening and who's doing what.
And it's
there's just, no secrets in the film industry.
Yeah. And the stuff you're doing, is it only you ever for films that are shot in the UK? That's a dumb question, but I don't know whether everything you've done is UK based.
I mean, they'll probably be based in the UK, but I've done the odd job where it's been filmed, might be filmed abroad, I think.
I'm just thinking of, like, you've got, like, Marvel Doomsday coming down the pipeline or whatever, and that presumably has got Benedict in it at some point or something or other. You wonder whether there'll be...
Yeah, I mean, there's so much is filmed over here these days.
Mm.
It's becoming quite, a good hub for filmmaking, the UK.
Mm.
Like, a lot of huge films are made here.
Have you got, has it changed? It's not like, so I used to work in a nightclub. It changes the way you look at nightclubs. I worked in a pub. It changes the way you look at pubs. You've worked in the movies. Does it change the way you look at movies?
Yeah, a little bit. I think I'm quite good at like detaching myself and being like, just get into the film. But sometimes I'm like, I don't like what they've done there or something like that.
Mm.
My sister is way worse. She's in film. She's an assistant costume designer.
Right.
Although never really got me a job, so she's not been that useful.
And she did do that thing for you when you were three, and you're just paying for that, basically, aren't you?
That's yeah. I think she's got me like a couple, which is nice. But like, she's the worst to watch films with. She'll be like, "That's not period correct," or you know. I wouldn't do that. And I'm just like...
But I guess, yeah, because your bit of the work as well is so abstract. It's not like you're going to have necessarily any idea what the story is or any of those sorts of things. Like, you're just making a product that's going to get used and that's that.
Yeah, exactly. Just, yeah, I'm just happy I've got a job and I'm sewing, to be honest.
The guy's going to bleed on it. I mean, at least I enjoyed making it before we bled on
it. Exactly. I had a nice time doing it. I had a good audiobook on and I had a lovely time.